horse moving riderless. Another came out of the smoke. Blowing smoke was... Another shell, very close, shook the ground, shook his vision. He hid behind the stone wall, stared very hard for a moment at a circle of greenish dried moss, the fine gray grain of the rock, the most vivid thing he had ever seen. What marvelous eyesight one has now. And he thought, must tell the men to keep down. But of course, that's stupid. They're down. Any fool knows that. Peeked up along the rock. Saw down to where shells were bursting along the road. Saw cooks and bakers scrambling to escape, horses and wagons wobbling away down the road. A shell hit a caisson and blew up in a great black tower of smoke, small black fragments whirling up into the air, fine dust sifting down everywhere, settling on the lips into the eyes. More sound now. Chamberlain turned, saw the Union guns beginning to open up, to give it back, saw forms moving in the smoke, saw a whole line fire at once, wondered if an attack was coming, thought, how can you form to repel an attack? You can't even stand. But it went on and on, all the guns in all the world firing, and the dust drifted down, and the smoke began to envelop him, and he lay finally face down against the dust. The grass, thinking, well, I'll just wait a bit and look out again. And then gradually the world softened and the sound was a great lullaby, thunderous, madly, liquidly soothing. And he fell asleep. Slept, but did not know how long, woke to the sound of the continuing guns. No difference. Looked out across the rock, smoke everywhere. Union guns firing, men moving among the guns, hunched. A bloody horse running eerily by, three-legged, horrible sight, running toward the road. Another horse down with no head, like a broken toy. Man nearby, lying on his back, one hand groping upward, oddly reaching for the sky. Chamberlain closed his eyes, slept again. Opened them and lost all sense of time. Had been sleeping since Noah in the sound of the guns. Had slept through the mud and the ooze and thousands of days since creation. The guns going on forever, like the endless rains of dawn. The earth was actually shuddering. It was as if you were a baby and your mother was shuddering with cold. More of the shells seemed to be passing overhead. He looked. There was a rider moving along in the smoke. Unbelievable. Familiar. Hancock. Chamberlain rose for a better look. It was Hancock, all right. General Hancock had mounted his horse and was riding slowly along that ripped and thundering crest, chatting through puffs of smoke and showers of dirt to the men behind the wall, the men crouched in holes. There was an orderly behind him carrying the flag of the corps. The two horses moved slowly, unconcernedly along. An incredible sight, a dreamlike sight. They moved on up the line, ethereal, untouched. But the shells were definitely beginning to pass overhead. The Rebs were lengthening their aim, beginning to fire high, too long. Chamberlain saw a solid shot furrow the earth, an instant hole, almost a tunnel. Black, spitting. And the shot rebounded 100 feet into the air, spinning off across the road. Another caisson went. The hospital was pooled in smoke, as in the morning mist. Chamberlain rolled over onto his back and lay for a while longer, hands clasped on his chest, gazing at the sky, trying to see the balls as they passed. He became aware for the first time of the incredible variety of sound. The great roar was composed of 1,000 different rips and whispers. Most incredible noise he had ever heard or imagined, like a great orchestra of death. All the sounds of myriad death. The wicker-wicker of certain shells. The weird thin scream of others. The truly frightful sound made by one strange species that came every few moments. An indescribable keening. Like old death, as a woman gone mad and a-hunting you, screaming. That would be the Whitworth, new English cannon the Rebs had. Then there were the sounds of the bursts, flat splats in the air, deeper bursts in ground, brutal smash and crack of shot into rock, shots splattering dirt and whining off, whispers of rock fragments and dirt fragments and small bits of metal and horse and man rippling the air, spraying the ground, humming the air, and the Union cannon braying away one after another, and an occasional scream, sometimes even joy, some of the cannoneers screaming with joy at hitting something, as when they saw a caisson blow up across the way. They could see the explosion from here, above the smoke, but not much else, too much smoke. Possibly that's why the Reb shells were going overhead. Reb artillery never very accurate, thank the Lord. Elevation too high now. And we ought to conserve our long-range stuff. They'll be coming now in a few moments, once the guns stop. God knows how many of them will come this time. Right in the path, Joshua, aren't you? Well, we ought to save our artillery then, damn it, and let them get out in the open. But they'll be coming again. Please, God, let's stop 'em. I have this one small regiment. He thought, must form the regiment. Face the crest. Enough ammunition? Send Tom to the rear. Poor old Kilrain. We'll miss you. We're right in the path. Would not have missed this for anything. Not anything in the world. We'll rest now. Dreamily. He put his face down. The shells fell all down the line, all over the crest, down in the road and back in the woods and on the hospital and in the artillery park. Chamberlain went to sleep. 4. Armstead. Saw it all begin. Saw the guns go off one by one, each one a split second after the last, so that there was one long, continuing, blossoming explosion, beginning on the right, erupting down through the grove and up the ridge to the left, like one gigantic fuse sputtering up the ridge. Armstead looked at his watch. 1:07. He could see shells bursting on top of the ridge, on the Union lines, saw a caisson blow up in a fireball of yellow smoke, heard wild cheering amid the great sound of the cannon. But then the smoke came boiling up the ridge, and he began to lose sight. Pickett was in front of him, out in the open, waving his hat and yelling wildly. Longstreet sat on a fence rail, motionless, crouched forward. There was too much smoke to see anything at all, just Longstreet's back, black, unmoving, and Pickett turning back through the smoke with joy in his face. And then the Union artillery opened up. The first shells came down in the trees beyond them. Longstreet turned slowly and looked. Then they began coming down in the field back there, where the division was. Armstead turned and ran back through the trees, across the ridge. The division lay in the open fields beyond the ridge. They had been there all morning, out in the open, through the growing heat. There was no protection. Knee-high grass, low stone walls. Off to the left, a low field of rye. The shells began to come in on them, and there was nothing to do but lie flat and hold the ground. Armstead walked out into the open, saw the men lying in long, clumped rows, as if plowed up out of the earth. Here and there an officer standing, a color sergeant. The flags erect in the earth and limp. No wind at all, and the shells bursting in sharp puffs everywhere, all down the line. Armstead walked among them. There was nothing he could do, no order to give. He saw the first bloody dead, heard the first agony. Men were telling him angrily to get down, get down! But he went on wandering. Off in the distance he could see Garnet doing the same, on horseback. After a while it was not really so bad. The shells were not so thick. They came down, and here and there a shock and a scream, but the masses of men lay in rows in the grass, and in the distance a band was playing. Armstead walked slowly back toward the trees, hoping to find out what was going on. His chest was very tight. He looked at his watch. 1:35. He wanted some moments to himself. The firing would stop, and then they would line up for the assault. Between that time and this, there ought to be a private moment. He came in under the trees and saw Longstreet writing a note, sending it with a galloping aide. There was Pickett, writing too, sitting on a camp stool, lost in thought, pen to his lips and staring off into space, as if composing a poem. Armstead smiled. He was closer to the guns now, and the sound of the cannonade was enormous, like a beating of great wings, and all around him the air was fluttering and leaves were falling and the ground was shaking, and there was Pickett writing a poem, face furrowed with mighty thought. Old George, never much of a thinker. And all that while in the back of Armstead's mind he could see Mary at the spinet. It may be for years. It may be forever. He could see the lips move, see tears on all the faces. But he could not hear that sound. The sound of the cannon was too great. He moved up closer to Pickett. Abruptly, not knowing beforehand that he would do it, he plucked the small ring from his little finger. Pickett looked up, his eyes glazed with concentration, focused. Blinked. Here, George. Send her this. My compliments. He handed Pickett the ring. Pickett took it. Looked at it. A sentimental man. He reached out and took Armstead's hand and pumped it wordlessly. Then flung an arm wildly out toward the guns, the noise, the hill to the east. Oh, God, Lo, isn't it something? Isn't it marvelous? How does a man find words? Tell me something to say, Lo. You're good at that. Lord, I thought we'd missed it all. But do you know this may be the last great fight of the war? Do you realize that? Isn't that marvelous? There was a long series of explosions. A tree limb burst. Armstead could hardly hear, but Pickett was profoundly moved. He was one of those, like Stuart, who looked on war as God's greatest game. At this moment, Armstead seemed to be looking down from a long way away, from a long, sleepy, hazy distance. George was grinning, clapping him on the arm. He said something about Sally having the ring mounted. Armstead moved away. He saw Longstreet sitting alone in the same place, on the same rail, drew comfort from the solid presence. Some officers had that gift. He did not. Hancock had it. Superb soldier. It may be for years. It may be forever. Don't think on that. He looked at his watch. 1:47. Cannot go on much longer. But he did not want to think about the attack right now. All the plans were laid. The thing was set. The others had planned it. Longstreet and Lee and Pickett, now he would carry it out. But for these last few moments, at least, the old soldier knows enough not to think about it. Shut the mind off, and think on better days. Remember things to be grateful for. Perhaps, like Pickett, you should write a letter. No, would say the wrong things. He went back toward his men, sat with his back against a tree, facing the open. He closed his eyes for a moment, and he could see her again, Mary. It may be for years, it may be forever, and Hancock's face in tears. May God strike me dead. He opened his eyes, looked a question at heaven, felt himself in the grip of these great forces, powerless, sliding down the long afternoon toward the end, as if it was all arranged somewhere, nothing he could have done to avoid it, not he or any Virginian. And he had said it and meant it. If I lift a hand against you, friend, may God strike me dead. Well, it is all in his hands. Armstead took off his black hat and ran his hands through the gray hair, his forehead wet with perspiration, the hair wet and glistening in the light. He was a grave and courtly man, a soldier all his life. He had a martial bearing, and the kind of face on which emotion rarely showed, a calm, almost regal quality. It had hindered him in the army because men thought he was not aggressive enough, but he was a good soldier, a dependable soldier, and all his life he had felt things more deeply than anyone knew, except her, so very briefly before she died, as she was dying. Don't think on that. But I loved her, and loved much else. Always loved music, and good friends, and some moments together. Had much joy in the weather, so very rarely shared. I should have shared more. The way Pickett does, the way so many do, it's a liquid thing with them, it flows. But I move on impulse. I gave him the ring. Premonition? Well, many will die. I'm a bit old for war. Will do my duty. I come from a line. No more of that. No need of that now. And Armstead does his duty. So do we all. But I wish it was not Hancock atop that hill. I wish this was Virginia again, my own green country, my own black soil. I wish the war was over. Quieter now. The fire was definitely slackening. 2:10. He sat patiently, his back to a tree. The attack would be soon enough. When he thought of that, his mind closed down like a blank gray wall, not letting him see. No point in thinking of that. He sat quietly, silently, suspended, breathing the good warm air, the smoke, the dust. Mustn't look ahead at all. One tends to look ahead with imagination. Must not look backward either. But it is so easy to see her there at the spinet, and all of us gathered round, and all of us crying. My dear old friend. Hancock has no time for painting now. He was rather good at it. Always meant to ask him for one of his works. Never enough time. Wonder how it has touched him. 2 years of war. Point of pride. My old friend is the best soldier they have. My old friend is up on that ridge. Here was Garnet. Dressed beautifully, new gray uniform, slender, trim, riding that great black mare with a smoky nose. Armstead stood. Garnet touched his cap. A certain sleepiness seemed to precede the battle, a quality of haze, of unreality, of dust in the air, dust in the haze. Garnet had the eyes of a man who had just awakened. Garnet said, "How are you, Lo?" Armstead said, "I'm fine, Dick." "Well, that's good." Garnet nodded, smiling faintly. They stood under the trees, waiting, not knowing what to say. The fire seemed to be slackening. Armstead said, "How's the leg?" "Oh, all right, thank you. Bit hard to walk. Guess I'll have to ride." "Pickett's orders. Nobody rides." Garnet smiled. "Dick," Armstead said, "you're not going to ride." Garnet turned, looked away. "You can't do that," Armstead insisted, the cold alarm growing. "You'll stand out like... you'll be a perfect target." "Well," Garnet said, grinning faintly, "well, I tell you, Lo, I can't walk and cannot stay behind. Honor at stake. He could not let the attack go without him. He had to prove once and for all his honor, because there was Jackson's charge, never answered, still in the air wherever Garnet moved, the word on men's lips, watching him as he went by, for Jackson was gone, and Jackson was a great soldier. There was nothing Armstead could say. He could feel tears coming to his eyes, but he could not even do that. Must not let Garnet see. There was always a chance. Perhaps the horse would be hit early. Armstead put out a hand, touched the horse. Sorry to wish death on anyone. Anything. Garnet said, "Just heard a funny thing. Thought you'd appreciate it." "Oh?" Armstead did not look him in the face. A shot took off the limb of a tree nearby, clipped it off cleanly, so that it fell all at once, making a sound like a whole tree falling. Garnet did not turn. "We have some educated troops, you know, gentlemen privates. Well, I was riding along the line, and I heard one of these fellas, ex-professor type, declaiming this poem. You know the one. Backward, turn backward, O time, in your flight, and make me a child again, just for this fight." And then there's a pause, and a voice says in a slow drawl, "Yep, a gal child." Garnet chuckled. "Harrison and I found us some Pennsylvania whiskey, and experimented, and found that it goes well with Pennsylvania water. Won't bad at all. Tried to save you some, but first thing you know..." He shrugged helplessly. Their eyes never quite met, like two lights moving, never quite touching. There was an awkward silence. Garnet said, "Well, I better get back." He moved back immediately, not attempting to shake hands. "I'll see you in a little bit," he said, and galloped off along the ridge. Armstead closed his eyes, prayed silently. "God protect him. Let him have justice. Thy will be done." Armstead opened his eyes. Had not prayed for himself. Not yet. It was all out of his hands, all of it. There was nothing he could do about anything anywhere in the whole world. Now he would move forward and lead the men up the ridge to whatever end awaited, whatever plan was foreordained, and he felt a certain mild detachment, a curious sense of dull calm, as on those long, long Sunday afternoons when you were a boy and had to stay dressed and neat and clean with nothing to do, absolutely nothing, waiting for the grown-ups to let you go, to give you the blessed release to run out in the open and play. So he did not even pray. Not yet. It was all in God's hands. Pickett rode toward him, staff trailing behind. The fire was definitely slower now. The air of the woods was clearing. Pickett's face was bright red. He reined up, but was hopping around in the saddle, patting the horse, slapping his own thigh, gesturing wildly, pointing, grinning. "Lewis, how's everything? Any questions?" Armstead shook his head. "Good, good. As soon as the guns cease fire, we step off. Garnet and Kemper, the first line, you're in the second. Route step, no halting, no stopping to fire. Want to get up there as fast as you can. I'll keep toward the right flank, to cover that side. Do you need anything?" "Nothing." "Good, fine." Pickett nodded violently. "How are you feeling?" "I'm fine." "That's good. One other point. All officers are ordered to walk. No officer takes his horse. Utterly foolish." Pickett's horse, catching the general's excitement, reared and wheeled. Pickett soothed him. "So you go on foot. No exceptions." "Yes," Armstead said. "But what about Garnet? What about..." "Oh," Pickett grimaced, "that leg." "I don't think he can walk," Pickett said slowly.
"Damn it."
"George, order him not to make the charge."
"I can't do that. He's in no condition."
But Pickett shook his head.
"You know I can't do that. A man on a horse in front of that line... George, he'll be the only rider in a line a mile wide. They'll have every gun on that hill on him.
Pickett rubbed the back of his neck, slammed his thigh.
He can't walk at all. He might get 50 yards.
Damn, Pickett said, caught himself guiltily. Not a good time to be swearing.
But you know how he feels. It's a matter of honor.
Pickett threw up his hands abruptly, helplessly.
Order him not to go, George.
Pickett shook his head reprovingly. Armstead said, All right, I understand. Yes, but I think I'm getting a bit old for this business. His voice was low, and Pickett did not hear it, was not even listening. Armstead rode with him back into the woods along Seminary Ridge. The woods were dark and blessedly cool. He saw Longstreet sitting on a rail fence, gazing out into the glittering fields toward the enemy line. Pickett rode toward him, and Longstreet turned slowly, swiveling his head, stared, said nothing. Pickett asked him about the guns. Longstreet did not seem to hear. His face was dark and still. He looked wordlessly at Pickett, then at Armstead, then turned back to the light. Pickett backed off. There was a savagery in Longstreet they all knew well. It showed rarely, but it was always there, and it was an impressive thing. Suddenly, in the dark grove, for no reason at all, Armstead looked at the dark face, the broad back, felt a bolt of almost stunning affection. It embarrassed him, but he thought, Before we go, I ought to say something. Longstreet had moved suddenly, turning away from the rail. Armstead saw Pickett running up through the trees, a note in his hand, his face flushed. Longstreet stopped, turned to look at him, turned slowly like an old man, looked at him with a strange face, a look tight and old that Armstead had never seen. Pickett was saying, Alexander says if we're going at all, now's the time. Longstreet stopped still in the dark of the woods. The huge glare behind him had made it difficult to see. Armstead moved that way, feeling his heart roll over and thump once. Pickett said, pointing, Alexander says we've silenced some Yankee artillery. They're withdrawing from the cemetery. What do you say, sir? Do we go in now? And Longstreet said nothing, staring at him, staring. And Armstead felt an eerie turning, like a sickness, watching Longstreet's face, and then he saw that Longstreet was crying. He moved closer. The general was crying, something he never saw or ever expected to see. And the tears came to Armstead's eyes as he watched, saw Pickett beginning to lift his hands, holding out the note, asking again, and then Longstreet took a deep breath, his shoulders lifted, and then he nodded, dropping his head, taking his eyes away from Pickett's face, and in the same motion turned away. And Pickett let out a whoop and clenched a fist and shook it. Then he pulled a letter from his pocket and wrote something on it and handed it to Longstreet. And Longstreet nodded again. And then Pickett was coming this way, face alight, look on his face of pure joy. And tears, too, eyes flashing and watery, but with joy, with joy. He said something about being chosen for glory, for the glory of Virginia. He said, Gentlemen, form your brigades! Armstead moved out, called the brigade to its feet. He felt curiously heavy, slow, very tired, oddly sleepy. The heat was stuffy. One had trouble breathing. The brigade dressed in a line. The fire had slackened all down the line. Now, for the first time, there were long seconds of silence, long moments of stillness. And you could hear again the voices of the men, the movements of feet in grass and the clink of sabers, muskets. And that band was still piping, a polka this time, tinny and bumpy, joyous, out of tune. The men dressed right, line after line. Armstead moved silently back and forth. Down to the left he saw Garnet still on the horse. A mounted man in front of that line would not live 5 minutes. every rifle on the crest would be aiming for him. The orders came, bawled by a bull sergeant. The line began to move forward into the woods, forward toward the great yellow light of the open fields on the other side. They moved through the woods in good order, past the silent guns. Almost all the guns were quiet now. Armstead thought, give the Yankees time to get set. Give Win Hancock time to get set. Move up reinforcements to the weak spots. Win, I'm sorry. Remember the old vow. May God strike me dead. And so the words came. I wish I could call them back. But Win understands. I have to come now. All in God's hands. Father, into your hands. To the left of the line, a rabbit broke from heavy brush, darted frantically out into the tall grass. A soldier said, close by, that's right, old hare, you run, you run. If I was an old hare, I'd run too. A murmur, a laugh. They came out of the woods into the open ground. The ground fell away from the woods into a shallow dip. They were out of sight of the Union line. To the left, there was a finger of woods between them and Pettigrew's men. They would not see Pettigrew until they had moved out away. The day was lovely and hot and still, not a bird anywhere. Armstead searched the sky, marvelous day, but very hot. He blinked. Would love to swim now. Cool, clear water. Lake water. Cool and dark at the bottom. Out of the light. The division was forming. Garnet was in front, Kemper to the right. Armstead's line lay across the rear. It was a matchless sight, the division drawn up as if for review. He looked down the line at the rows of guns, the soft blue flags of Virginia. He began to look at the faces, the tight faces, the eyes wide and dark and open. And he could hear more bands striking up far off to the right. No hurry now. A stillness everywhere. That same dusty, sleepy pause. The men not talking. No guns firing. Armstead moved forward through the ranks. Saw Garnet on the horse. Went over to say goodbye. Garnet no longer looked well. His coat was buttoned at the throat. Armstead said, Dick! For God's sake and mine, get down off the horse. Garnet said, I'll see you at the top, Lo. He put out his hand. Armstead took it. Armstead said, My old friend. It was the first time in Armstead's life he had ever really known a man would die. Always before, there was at least a chance. But here, no chance at all. And now the man was his oldest friend. Armstead said, I ought to ride too. Garnet said, Against orders. Armstead looked down the long line. Have you ever seen anything so beautiful? Garnet smiled. Armstead said, They never looked better on any parade ground. They never did. Armstead heard once more that sweet female voice, unbearable beauty of the unbearable past. It may be for years, it may be forever. Then why art thou silent? He still held Garnet's hand. He squeezed once more. Nothing more to say now. Careful now. He let the hand go. He said, Goodbye, Dick. God bless you. Garnet nodded. Armstead turned away, walked back to his brigade. Now, for the first time, at just the wrong time, the acute depression hit him a blow to the brain. Out of the sleepiness, the face of despair. He remembered Longstreet's tears. He thought, a desperate thing. But he formed the brigade. Out front, George Pickett had ridden up before the whole division, was making a speech. But he was too far away, and none of the men could hear. Then Pickett raised his sword. The order came down the line. Armstead, his voice never strong, bawled hoarsely, with all his force. All right now, boys, for your wives, your sweethearts, for Virginia, at root step, forward, ho! He drew his sword, pointed it toward the ridge. The brigade began to move. He heard a chattering begin in the ranks. Someone seemed to be trying to tell a story. A man said, "Save your breath, boy." They moved in the tall grass, Garnet's whole line in front of them. The grass was trampled now, here and there apart in the line as men stepped aside to avoid a dead body lost the day before. Armstead could still see nothing, nothing but the backs of the troops before him. He saw one man falter, looking to the right, gray-faced, to the sergeant who was watching him, had evidently been warned against him, now lifted a rifle and pointed it that way, and the man got back into line. The northern artillery opened up, as if it had been asleep, or pulled back to lure them in. Massive wave of fire rolled over from the left. Pettigrew was getting it. Then on the right, batteries on the rocky hill were firing on Kemper. Garnet not yet really touched. Nothing much coming this way. But we didn't drive off any Yankee guns. Wind's doing. He made them cease fire, knowing soon we'd be in the open. Guns to the left and right, nothing much in the center. Garnet's doing well. He began to see. They were coming out into the open, up to where the ground dipped toward the Emmitsburg Road. Now, to the left, he could see the great mass of Pettigrew's division, with Trimble coming up behind him, advancing in superb order, line after line, a stunning sight, red battle flags, row on row. Could not see Pettigrew nor Trimble. The line must be a mile long, a mile of men armed and coming, the earth shuddering with their movement, with the sound of the guns. A shell exploded in Garnet's line. Another. Gaps began to appear. Armstead heard the sergeant's hoarse, "Close it up! Close it up!" And behind him he heard his own men coming, and a voice saying calmly, cheerily, "Steady, boys, steady, there now. You can see the enemy. Now you ain't blind anymore. Now you know exactly where's to go. Ain't that fine?" A voice said hollowly, "That's just fine." But the artillery sound was blossoming. A whole new set of batteries opened up. He could see smoke rolling across the top of the hill, and no counterfire from behind. No southern batteries. God, he thought, they're out of ammunition. But no, of course not. They just don't like firing over our heads. And even as he thought of that, he saw a battery moving out of the woods to his left, being rushed up to support the line. And then the first shell struck near him, percussion, killing a mass of men to his right rear, his own men. And from then on the shells came down increasingly, as the first fat drops of an advancing storm. But it was not truly bad. "Close it up, close it up!" Gaps in front, the newly dead, piles of red meat. One man down, holding his stomach, blood pouring out of him like a butchered pig. Young face. Only a boy. The man bending over him, trying to help. A sergeant screaming, "Damn it! I said close it up!" Kemper's brigade ahead and to the right was getting it. The batteries on the rocky hill were enfilading him, shooting right down his line, sometimes with solid shot, and you could see the damn black balls bouncing along like bowling balls, and here and there in the air tumbling over and over like a blood-spouting cartwheel, a piece of a man. Armstead turned to look back. Solid line behind him. God bless them, coming on. Not so bad now, is it? We'll do it. With God's help. Coming they are, to a man. All good men here. He turned back to the front. Garnet's men were nearing the road. He could see old Dick, still there on the great black horse. And then the first storm of musketry. A line of skirmishers. He winced. Could not see, but knew. Long line of men in blue, lined, waiting, their sights set, waiting. And now the first line of gray is near, clear, nearer, unmissable,
An officer screams. If they're soldiers at all, they cannot miss. And they're Hancock's men.
Armstead saw a visible waver pass through the ranks in front of him.
Close it up! Close it up!
The line seemed to have drifted slightly to the left. Heavy roll of musket fire now. The march slowing. He saw Garnet move down, thought for a moment, but no. He was moving down into that one swale, the protected area Pickett had spoken of. Armstead halted the men. Stood incredibly still in the open field with the artillery coming down like hail, great bloody hail. To the left, 200 yards away, Pettigrew's men were slowing. Some of the men in front had stopped to fire. No point in that. Too soon, too soon. Pickett's left oblique began. The whole line shifted left, moving to join with Pettigrew's flank to close the gap. It was beautifully done. Superbly done. Under fire, in the face of the enemy. Armstead felt enormous pride. His chest filled and stuffed with a furious love. He peered left. Could not see Trimble. But they were closing in, the great mass converging. Now he moved up, and he could see the clump of trees, the one tree like an umbrella, Lee's objective. And then it was gone in smoke. Garnet's boys had reached the road. They were slowing, taking down rails. Musket fire was beginning to reach them. The great noise increased, beating of wings in the air. More dead men. A long, neat line of dead like a shattered fence. And now the canister, oh God, he shuddered. Millions of metal balls whirring through the air like startled quail, murderous quail. And now, for the first time, there was screaming. Very bad sounds to hear. He began to move past wounded, struggling to the rear, men falling out to help. Heard the sergeants ordering the men back into line. Saw gray faces as he passed, eyes sick with fear. But the line moved on. Dress it up! Close it up! He looked back for a moment and walked backward up the long rise, looking backward at his line coming steadily, slowly, heads down as if into the wind. Then he turned back to face the front. To the right, the line was breaking. He saw the line falter, the men beginning to clump together, massed fire from there. In the smoke, he could see a blue line. Kemper's boys were shifting this way, slowing. Armstead was closing in. He saw a horse coming down through the smoke. Kemper, riding. Because Garnet rode. Still alive, even on the horse. But there was blood on his shoulder, blood on his face. His arm hung limp. He had no sword. He rode to Armstead, face streaked and gray, screaming something Armstead could not hear. Then came up closer and turned, waving the bloody arm.
Got to come up! Come up! Help me! In God's name! They're flanking me! They're coming down on the right and firing right into us! The line's breaking! We've got to have help!
Armstead yelled encouragement. Kemper tried to explain. They could not hear each other. A shell blew very close on the far side of the horse, and Armstead, partially shielded, saw black fragments rush by, saw Kemper nearly fall. He grabbed Kemper's hand, screaming, "I'll double time!" Kemper said, come quick, for God's sake!" and reined the horse up and turned back to the right. And beyond him, Armstead saw a long blue line, Union boys out in the open, kneeling and firing from the right. And beyond that violent light of rows of cannon, and another flight of canister passed over. Kemper's men had stopped to fire, were drifting left. Too much smoke to see. Armstead turned, called his aides, took off the old black felt, and put it on the tip of his sword and raised it high in the air. He called for double time, double time! The cry went down the line. The men began to run. He saw the line waver, ragged now. Long legs beginning to eat up the ground, shorter legs falling behind, gaps appearing, men actually seeming to disappear, just to vanish out of the line, leaving a stunned vacancy, and the line slowly closing again, close it up, beginning to ripple and fold, but still a line, still moving forward in the smoke and the beating noise. They came to the road. It was sunken into the field, choked like the bed of a stream with mounded men. Armstead jumped down, saw a boy in front of him, kneeling, crying. A row of men crouched under the far bank, an officer yelling, pounding with the flat of his sword. There was a house to the right, smoke pouring from the roof, a great clog of men jammed behind the house. But men were moving across the road and up toward the ridge. There was a boy on his knees on the road edge, staring upward toward the ridge, unmoving. Armstead touched him on the shoulder, said, "Come on, boy. Come on." The boy looked up with sick eyes, eyes soft and black like pieces of coal. Armstead said, "Come on, boy. What will you think of yourself tomorrow?" The boy did not move. Armstead told an officer nearby, "Move these people out." He climbed up the road bank, over the gray rails on the far side, between two dead bodies. One a sergeant, face vaguely familiar, eyes open, very blue. Armstead stood high, trying to see. Kemper's men had come apart, drifting left. There was a mass ahead, but it did not seem to be moving. Up there the wall was a terrible thing, flame and smoke. He had to squint to look at it, kept his head down, looked left, saw Pettigrew's men still moving, but the neat lines were gone, growing confusion. The flags dropping, no rebel yell now, no more screams of victory. The men falling here and there like trees before an invisible axe. You could see them go, one by one and in clumps, suddenly, in among the columns of smoke from the shell. Far to the left he saw. Pettigrew's men were running. He saw a red flag streaming back to the rear. One of Pettigrew's brigades had broken on the far left. Armstead raised his sword, saw that the sword had gone through the hat, and the hat was now down near his hand. He put the hat up again, the sword point on a new place, started screaming, "Follow me! Follow me!" and began the long last walk toward the ridge. No need for hurry now. Too tired to run, expecting to be hit at any moment. Over on the right, no horse. Kemper was down. Impossible to live up there. Armstead moved on, expecting to die, but was not hit. He moved closer to the wall up there, past mounds of bodies, no line anymore, just men moving forward at different speeds, stopping to fire, stopping to die, drifting back like leaves blown from the fire ahead. Armstead thought, "We won't make it." He lifted the sword again, screaming, and moved on, closer, closer. But it was all coming apart. The whole world was dying. Armstead felt a blow in the thigh, stopped, looked down at blood on his right leg. But no pain. He could walk. He moved on. There was a horse coming down the ridge, great black horse with blood all over the chest, blood streaming through bubbly holes, blood on the saddle, dying eyes, smoke gray at the muzzle. Garnet's horse. Armstead held to watch the horse go by, tried to touch it. He looked for Garnet ahead. He might be afoot, might still be alive. But vision was mistier, much, much smoke. Closer now. He could see separate heads. He could see men firing over the wall. The charge had come to a halt. The attack had stopped. The men ahead were kneeling to fire at the blue men on the far side of the wall, firing at the gunners of the terrible cannon. Canister came down in floods, wiping bloody holes. A few flags tilted forward, but there was no motion. The men had stalled, unable to go on, still 30 yards from the wall and no visible halt, unable to advance, unwilling to run, a deadly paralysis. Armstead stopped, looked. Pettigrew's men were coming up on the left, not many, not enough. Here he had a few hundred. To the right, Kemper's brigade had broken, but some of the men still fired. Armstead paused for one long second. "It's impossible now. Cannot be done. We have failed, and it's all done. All those boys are dead. It's all done." And then he began to move forward automatically, instinctively, raising the black hat on the sword again, beginning to scream, "Virginians, with me! With me!" And he moved forward the last yards toward the wall, drawn by the pluck of that great force from within, for home, for country.
and now the ground went by slowly, inexorably, like a great slow river. And the moment went by black and slow, close to the wall, closer, walking now on the backs of dead men, troops around beginning to move, yelling at last a wild rebel yell, and the blue troops begin to break from the fence. Armstead came up to the stone wall, and the blue boys were falling back. He felt a moment of incredible joy. A hot slap of air brushed his face, but he was not hit. To the right, a great blast of canister, and all the troops to his right were down. But then there was another rush, and Armstead leaped to the top of the wall, balanced high on the stones, seeing the blue troops running up the slope into the guns. And then he came down on the other side, had done it, had gotten inside the wall, and men moved in around him, screaming. And then he was hit, finally in the side, doubling him. No pain at all, merely a nuisance. He moved toward a cannon the boys had just taken. Some blue troops had stopped near the trees above and were kneeling and firing. He saw the rifles aimed at him. Too weary now. He had made it all this way. This way was enough. He put an arm on the cannon to steady himself. But now there was a rush from the right. Blue troops were closing in. Armstead's vision blurred. The world turned soft and still. He saw again, a bloody tangle, men fighting hand to hand. An officer was riding toward him. There was a violent blow. He saw the sky, swirling round and round. Thank God, no pain. A sense of vast release, of great peace. I came all the way up. I came over the wall. He sat against something. The fight went on. He looked down at his chest, saw the blood, tried to breathe, experimentally. But now he could feel the end coming. Now, for the first time, he sensed the sliding toward the dark, a weakening, a closing, all things ending now slowly and steadily and peacefully. He closed his eyes, opened them. A voice said, I was riding toward you, sir, trying to knock you down. You didn't have a chance. He looked up. A Union officer. I am not captured. I am dying. He tried to see. Help me. Help me. He was lifted slightly. Everywhere the dead. All his boys. Blue soldiers stood around him. Down the hill he could see the gray boys moving back, a few flags fluttering. He closed his eyes on the sight, sank down in the dark, ready for death. Knew it was coming. But it did not come. Not quite yet. Death comes at its own speed. He looked into the blue sky at the shattered trees. It may be for years. It may be forever. The officer was speaking. Armstead said, Is General Hancock? Would like to see General Hancock. A man said, I'm sorry, sir. General Hancock has been hit. No, Armstead said. He closed his eyes. Not both of us. Not all of us. Sent to Myra Hancock, to be opened in the event of my death. But not both of us. Please, dear God. He opened his eyes. Closer now. The long, slow fall begins. Will you tell General Hancock? Can you hear me, son?
I can hear you, sir.
Will you tell General Hancock, please, that General Armstead sends his regrets? Will you tell him how very sorry I am?
The energy failed. He felt himself flicker. But it was a long, slow falling, very quiet, very peaceful, rather still. but always the motion, the darkness closing in. And so he fell out of the light and away, far away, and was gone. 5. Longstreet. Longstreet sat on a rail fence, hugging his chest with both arms. He suspended, thinking. His mind was a bloody vacancy, like a room in which there has been a butchering. He tried once formally to pray, but there was no one there, and no words came. And over he said to himself, "Heavenly Father, Heavenly Father." He watched the battle dissolve to nightmare, the neat military lines beginning to come apart as they crossed the road, and no order beyond that but black, struggling clots and a few flags in the smoke, tilting like sails above a white sea, going down one by one. A shell burst near Longstreet, and he felt the hot, brutal breath, and then the sounds of battle were softer. The smoke began to blanket the field. But there were still a few flags moving toward the top of the hill. Longstreet put glasses to his eyes, saw ghost figures stumbling in white smoke, yellow blaze of cannon, black flakes of men spattering upward into a white sky. And then the smoke was too thick, and he could not see anything, and it was like going blind. A paralysis came over him. He sat staring off into the white sea, where the guns still flashed and boomed softly at a great distance, until he saw the first men beginning to come back out of the smoke. They came slowly up the long green slope, a ragged crowd of men. No one was running. They were moving with slow, set, stubborn, unstoppable looks on their faces, eyes down, guns dragging the ground. And they were moving slowly but steadily, even though the Union guns had elevated and shells were still falling on them as they came back up the field. The smoke parted for a vision. The green field dirtied a vast mile with lumped bodies, white and red. And far across the field, the whole army falling back in a speckled flood across the road to the safety of the woods. And there, at the top of the hill, one flag erect near the center of the Union line. Then that flag was down in the smoke, and Longstreet could no longer see, and the retreat began to flood by him. The men parted as they passed him, not looking at him. He sat on an island in the stream of retreating men. He made no attempt to stop them. A man rode up on a black horse, a frantic man with blood on his face, Harry Bright, picket staff. He was screaming. Longstreet stared at him. The man went on screaming. Longstreet made out. Pickett was asking for support. Longstreet shook his head, wordlessly, pointed down at the field. Bright did not yet understand. Longstreet said patiently, "Nine brigades went in. That's all we have." There was nothing to send now, no further help to give, and even if Lee on the other side would send support now, it would be too late. Longstreet hugged his chest. He got down off the fence. A black horse rode up out of the smoke, familiar spot on a smoky forehead, blood bubbling from a foaming chest. Garnet's mount. Longstreet nodded. He told Bright to instruct Pickett to fall back. He sent word for a battery to move down the slope in front of him, to fire uphill and protect Pickett as he retreated. The wind had changed. The smoke was blowing back across the field against his face. The guns were easing off. The men streamed by. Nightmare army. Faces gray and cold. Sick. Longstreet felt a cold wind blowing in his brain. He stood up. He had sat long enough. He looked up to see Fremantle. A moment ago, the man had been cheering wildly, not understanding what was happening. Now he was holding out a silver flask. Longstreet shook his head. It was all done. along with all the horror of loss, the weariness, and all the sick, helpless rage, there was coming now a monstrous disgust. He was through. They had all died for nothing.